Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is National Sales Manager of Wireworld Cable Technology, Larry Smith. He's going to educate us on all sorts of cable issues that we might not even think about too often. But first, let's talk about the music business of the week, which is Yahoo introducing their own video service. Probably most of you don't know that there are 62 other services besides YouTube. It's 62 other video services out there worldwide now besides YouTube. No one is even close to being as big as YouTube. And for some reason, Yahoo thinks that they can take them on. The way we found this out was that Yahoo is approaching very popular YouTube content creators and is trying to sign them up. And while this is probably a good strategy, the real problem here is that it's Yahoo. And Yahoo has a bad track record for either starting new businesses, starting new divisions, starting new features, or acquiring businesses. And usually what ends up happening is they acquire them and it doesn't go anywhere. Nothing really happens. So they have a really bad track record. They tried to acquire Daily Motion last year, and Daily Motion, again, it's one of the big four competitors to YouTube, and that's not really saying much because they're not much of a competitor in the grand scheme of things, although people do actually check it out from time to time. YouTube is still the biggest by far. Now, here's the thing that's going to happen on the Yahoo video service, as has been reported. Now, we don't know because it's not a real service yet. This is just the reports that are coming in from the people that have been approached. You're going to have your own channel, just like you do on YouTube. And you're going to have a dashboard, and that will enable you to publish to the Yahoo homepage. And the Yahoo homepage is actually very important because that's still one of, the top five most visited pages anywhere. Yahoo News and the Yahoo homepage is widely, widely visited. So if you can get your video on that front page, that's really significant. Although the chances of that happening are probably small, just the fact that there is a chance, that's pretty cool. And I must admit, that's attractive for the service. Now, the other thing that you can do is publish directly to Tumblr, which, again, this sounds like it's a pretty cool feature, except there's a little gotcha there. What Yahoo has in their contract is that if you publish something through Yahoo Video, through Tumblr, suddenly they own the perpetual worldwide rights, or they get to control the perpetual worldwide rights, which is the same thing as owning the video, or owning the content. As a result, most content creators that have been approached on this have balked because, again, you spend a lot of time on your videos, and even if you didn't, you thought it out, and it takes some time to put it up and to put it together. Why should someone else own your content just because they're distributing it? Besides, you're not guaranteed to get any money out of it. Now, hopefully you will, but there's no guarantee. So this is a very, very big stumbling block. Once again, what ends up happening with Yahoo is they tend to screw these types of things up. So in fact, by the time this actually gets out to the public, I would say that contract is most likely going to be modified, but you never know with Yahoo. Anyway, there's going to be a brand new video service in town that's going to try to go up and compete against the 8,000-pound gorilla, not even an 800-pound gorilla. YouTube is an 8,000-pound gorilla. So good luck to Yahoo on that. But anyway, be on the lookout because it still might be something that you might want to check out. The other thing that was interesting this week is the report that Apple is going to replace the 3.5-millimeter or 1/8-inch jack that comes on iDevices. So in other words, the headphone jack that you find on your iPhone and your iPad. And they're going to replace it with a lightning connector. The lightning connector is the same connector that you use to power your iPhone 5. I think that this is actually a great idea. There's a lot of people that are saying, oh, Apple, look at them. They're trying to do a proprietary connector, so you have to buy their headphones. But I look at it another way. I think this is a great thing. The 1/8-inch connector has always been a really bad idea. It's really flimsy. It's impossible to wire. I mean, get your microscope out if you're going to try to wire one up yourself. And they break very, very easily. The jack breaks more so than the plug. I think replacing that is actually a good idea. Now, here's what you get. Being able to add this brand new lightning connector also allows you to power electronics in the headphones. Now, think about this. There can be a digital to audio converter built right into your headphones that can be powered, that can get the digital audio through the lightning connector. So, in fact, if you want to upgrade your system, upgrade the sound quality, all you have to do is buy a really good pair of headphones that has the digital audio converter built in. And this is kind of cool because it's a brand new development. It's not something that we've seen before, something like this. The other thing is that since it has a lightning connector, you'll be able to actually control a lot more. You can control just about everything on your audio, and you can do it from your headphones or from something in between the cable. So this sounds pretty cool, actually, except when you look at it from the standpoint that, well, what happens if you need an extension cable? Most people don't if they're connecting to their iPhone, for instance. But what if you do? Well, that's a very expensive cable if you're going to have to get a lightning extender, because lightning connectors are fairly expensive, a lot more so than an eighth inch cable or a cable with an eighth inch jack and plug on each side. So that's kind of interesting. And the other thing is, what if you like a certain set of headphones that you have that you've always used and you're used to using on your iPhone, your iPad, whatever the case, and suddenly on this next new version that you get, you can't use them any longer? Is that going to be a bummer to you? I don't know. Tell me. Let me know if that's something that might be an impediment for you. On the other hand, Apple has been replacing connectors, drives, all sorts of things way before the market has demanded it. And if you go back to the floppy disk, for instance, they got rid of those long before the market was demanding it and everybody was up in arms. Same thing with the CD player, DVD player. Try to buy a Mac now with one and you can't. But then again, when is the last time you actually needed a CD drive or a DVD drive? It probably was quite a while ago. The other thing they just recently did was they got rid of FireWire on the computers and replaced it with Thunderbolt. And believe me, I'm kind of going through that kind of hell now where you have to change everything over from FireWire. All of my drives are on FireWire, and suddenly now I have to change to a Thunderbolt-based ecosystem. And it's painful. On the other hand, there's so much to like about Thunderbolt. It's so much faster. It's so much easier. Everything's a lot better about it. So I'm going gracefully into it instead of kicking and screaming. So look for that coming soon. You can also look for the fact that this will probably be started with a Beats headphone, because that's the report so far. So that kind of defeats the purpose, I think, but we shall see. So those are the two big pieces of news this week. Yahoo introducing their own video service and Apple replacing the eighth inch headphone jack on future iDevices. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. It's questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Larry Smith, and he's the National Sales Manager of WireWorld Cable Technology. Larry's going to bust some myths about all kinds of cable and explain why high-quality cables are so important in the first place. I spoke with Larry via Skype at his home in Florida. Larry, thanks so much for being on my podcast today. Appreciate you taking the time.
It's my pleasure, Bobby. Thanks for having me.
And let's start right in on something here. Why does cable matter? Why do the cables that you use matter?
Well, you know, cable, some mastering engineers find that it acts almost like an EQ, like a filter. You know, I can go into a room of either audiophiles or just hi-fi enthusiasts, and a lot of times I'll start a presentation asking, what sounds better, a long cable or a short cable? And invariably people say, well, a short cable does. And that's because cable, by its very nature, is a lossy medium. And our job as a cable manufacturer is to find ways to minimize the lossiness.
Well, what makes your cable different than, let's say, just common cable that you'd pick up at Guitar Center or something? Many of us were brought up on the notion that cable is cable for the most part.
A large portion of the cable that's manufactured, cable is cable. What WireWorld does differently is we use patented proprietary design elements. The actual geometry, the design, the topology of the cable itself is patented. It's a very new patent. It just came through in September of last year. Something that we call DNA Helix. Most cable utilizes design that is from the 1880s or 1890s, and twisted pair and coaxial.
From way back then? Really? I didn't even realize there was wire back then.
Yeah, that's what the telegraph systems were all about.
Oh, I guess.
And so twisted pair and coaxial are the foundation of most of the cable design, and it doesn't matter what the particular cable is, whether you're talking about a microphone cable, an instrument cable, an interconnect in a hi-fi, or speaker cable.
Well, I know Greg Calabi, for instance, who's a big proponent of your cable, and he talks about using different interconnects as an EQ, actually, and for different genres of music. I'm curious, so how does that work exactly? Why is it different? You said it's a topology that you're using, but what's actually happening inside? Why am I not getting what I need out of common, cheap cable?
One thing to consider is not all expensive cable is necessarily going to be better than better than a generic cable. And this is the thing that I want to start on before I get into real design elements and specifics. Is my company is the second company that David Sauls, our founder and president, he's our designer, it's the second company that he's started. And the reason he got into cable design was back in 1980, he wasn't getting the results from a hi-fi that he thought he should get. And just on a lark, he physically backed a preamplifier up to a power amplifier and connected it with barrel connectors and thought, wow, everything got so much better by getting rid of the cable. And instinctively, he knew the cable was a lossy medium. And so he set about ways to minimize the loss. And so he's been designing cables since the very early 1980s. We believe that there is a scientific measure for what a cable should sound like, and that is we believe that a cable should be truly neutral. A lot of cable manufacturers talk about building neutral product, but they don't necessarily have a benchmark. Our benchmark is no cable. So we will physically back a power amplifier up to a speaker. Now, there has to be something involved, but, we can use an inch or two of just an OFC with connectors on it, a little piece of OFC copper with connectors on it, and we're effectively eliminating the cable. With a CD player to a preamp, that connection, it's funny because David's original thing was using off-the-shelf barrel connectors, but we found that the barrel connectors that you'd buy in like a Radio Shack actually don't sound very good. They're made of very poor quality metals. So we use a higher quality RCA connector with a tiny piece of an OFC hookup wire. And when I say tiny, I'm talking about, anywhere from an inch to 2 inches to 3 inches, depending on if the RCA connections line up perfectly and I can physically back a CD player up to a preamp, I may be able to get away with something that's, total distance, maybe an inch and a half or 2 inches tip to tip of the RCA elements. With XLR cable, we only use the contact portion from an XLR. We don't use the outer shell. There's no need for an outer shell. So we use just the contacts and, again, have, an inch and a half of just a high-quality OFC, nothing proprietary about the wire that we're using. Just something that allows a pin-to-pin contact to be made. And when you set a benchmark of building a product that's tonally neutral, that doesn't impart a sonic, that doesn't act as an EQ, you can really hear what's happening with the lossiness of cable.
Now, I read on your site that, in fact, you're talking about the design of the cable as well, but you also have a custom insulation and silver clad contacts and things like that. And they make a big difference
Oh, absolutely. You know, just from a standpoint of metallurgy, if you take, you know, copper, we all know that copper is an excellent electrical conductor. So if copper represents 100% of conductivity, you can scale things and see where other elements come in. For example, oxygen-free copper goes up to 101%. It's more conductive than plain copper. OCC, ono continuous cast copper, which yields 6-9 purity. It's a patented process that's only available from very few factories around the world, and we use it in our better products. OCC is 103%. Silver is 106%. And then you look at things like gold at, I don't have a chart in front of me, but somewhere around 60%. Nickel is 25%. Rhodium, which is a big popular connector now, rhodium is just slightly more conductive than nickel. And you'll find people that are putting rhodium over nickel to make their plugs. Well, if, you know, my base metal is 25% the conductivity of copper, right there's a loss.
Yeah. Yeah, I see. Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I see that you have numerous tiers of cables, models of cables.
Right.
And why is that then? Is that strictly to make things more affordable then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we want to be able to offer a true upgrade at any price. Something unique to our line is as you move up models, you're getting either an improved metallurgy. For example, you'll go from OFC to OCC, or you'll go from OFC to silver plated or silver clad OFC, and then to OCC, ono continuous cast copper, and then to silver plated or clad OCC copper, and then to solid silver, and then our flagship cables are actually OCC solid silver.
Wow.
So you've got 6-9 purity, 99.99997% pure silver.
They're not very flexible, I would imagine, then, right?
Well, that's the other thing that happens as you move up the line. There will be cases where you're dealing with the same metallurgy, but then we're increasing the gauge. You know, we don't necessarily offer the heaviest gauge products out there because the gauge really only helps with resistive loss. Resistive loss is actually fairly linear. So in other words, you're not going to get, if you have a cable that has a lot of resistive loss, it can still be very sonically neutral. It doesn't necessarily tilt one way or the other with regards to frequency response. And one of the funny things is, you know, we find, you know, there are audiophiles out there that are kind of like cable of the month people that are always changing cables out in order to tweak a system, you know, because some cables do different things well. But those same people would balk at the idea of putting an EQ in their system. Well, really, all they're doing with the cables is, you know, it's a form of equalization. We'd be much higher proponents of the idea, you know, if you think you need to tweak the frequency response, then use an EQ, use the right tool.
Let's talk about studio for a second, and I want to talk about guitar players or musicians in a little bit.
Sure.
So it can be really expensive if you're going to replace all of your cables in your studio with premium cables like you sell.
Sure.
So assuming that the average studio owner can't do that, what would be the one place that he could replace something and have it make a difference?
You know, with studio applications, you know, the two bus for the mastering, you know, is obviously a critical component. We've done several mastering studios, and typically they kind of back their way through the signal chain with the things that are more critical. You know, that the fancy DAX output, you know, maybe you've got one channel strip that you just absolutely love, and you know, there's never any harm in replacing things at the front end. Mic cables, instrument cables can make a huge difference. So, you know, I tell people that, you know, the obviously the componentry that's involved more often, those are the cables that I recommend upgrading first.
Now, I know for a mastering studio, they usually use passive speakers, so I would think that the first thing you would do is you'd do the speaker cable.
Speaker cable, sure. Absolutely. But, you know, again, speaker cable without upgrading the interconnects. Also, in a mastering studio, you may or may not have, you know, depending on the mastering studio, you may have monoblock amplifiers sitting there, and the you may be dealing with a one and a half meter run from the amp to the speaker, but you may be dealing with a 5 meter run getting to the amps. In that case, I'd probably say that balanced cable going to the amp is more important, just because of the, you know, the resistive speaker cable is where you've got the most loss. There's no doubt about it. One of the reasons I love powered monitors, you know.
Yeah, right.
But you know, it's all kind of to scale. You know, if what the passive speaker is a more humble speaker, you know, if you've got a wall of speakers and you're worried about cabling up your NS10Ms, that doesn't need to be an expensive cable necessarily.
Yeah, right. It's probably counterproductive to do that, I would say.
Right.
So does it make that much of a difference for a guitar player?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I know there are people with golden ears that really get particular about things, you know, the type of batteries they use in their effects and stuff like that, which I don't know that I've ever been a proponent of. But that being said, there are people that can hear those differences. So, but cable, for instance, so guitar into an amplifier, yes, makes a difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, if you think about it, one of the known noise properties of cable is microphonics triboelectric noise. Okay, so even if you take microphonics out of it, just triboelectric noise, the self-noise of the cable as it physically moves, and triboelectric noise can be triggered by micro-vibrations. I mean, you'll see people with many thousands of dollars of stabilization when it comes to audiophile systems, right? That's to try to eliminate micro vibration. Well, it happens to cable too. But now I've got a 15 or a 20 foot lead going to my amplifier that I'm literally flipping all over the place. We showed at NAMM for the first time this year and had a lot of fun playing with microphonics of cables, because it's remarkable how much noise you can get if you dime the preamp section of a tube amp. You can keep the master down, but you know, go ahead and run the gain hard on the preamp and tap a guitar cable. Hmm. And you know, okay, so now I'm kind of dancing around. I'm stomping on effects. I'm physically moving, and there is all kinds of noise that's being picked up just through that cable. So if you can design a cable that has a lower noise floor, you know, in an audiophile world, you're going to notice greater dynamics immediately. In a studio, everything just sounds better. I mean, I've gotten testimonials from some musicians that just talk about how absolutely shocked they are when they plug a cable in at, you know, all this noise that they were hearing before, that you kind of tend to tune it out. You know, I mean, in your studio, you don't necessarily, you may not be aware of all the noise that's there until all of a sudden it goes away.
Yeah. There's a company who shall remain nameless who sent me an active cable.
Right.
And I gave it to a number of the studio guys that I know. Everybody hated it.
Right.
And they hated it because it was actually too neutral, they said. I'm not sure that was the case, but I think whatever it was, it changed what they were expecting to hear.
Right.
And they just couldn't buy into it at all. So, you know, I'm wondering, that is part of the the sound that you have, once you're used to the sound or whatever it is, when you change something, you know, I could see how somebody would either, you know, jump on board and say, wow, that's the greatest thing ever, or not get it at all. It's hard.
Right.
I guess it's hard
right.
to be neutral.
And it's funny because there are some preconceptions here. One of my really good buddies is, you know, he's a Tele player. He's got a Silverface Princeton Reverb. And we had gotten in kind of a philosophical discussion about cable before I ever put a guitar cable in his hands. He was saying, but, you know, the lossiness of that old cloth braided cable, you know, that, but that's part of the sound, man. When I listen to these records from the 50s and the 60s, you know, they didn't have this fancy stuff that's tonally neutral. And maybe I need that to get the sound that I want. And, well, you know, guess what happened when I gave him a cable?
Changed his mind, huh?
Yeah, he loved it.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Absolutely. You know, if you can get more tone out of an instrument, I mean, that's what musicians really want, right? You want your instrument to be a reflection of yourself. And I know there's a lot of people that are chasing somebody else's sound. And, you know, God bless them if that's what you want. But I think really what it comes down to is you want all the tone that your instrument's able to give you. And we think that our cables do that better than anything else, even without getting into lofty price points.
How about digital cables?
Yeah, digital cables make a huge difference.
And is it the jitter? Is it cutting down on jitter? Or is it stopping extra jitter from happening? What is that? What's the reason?
That's pretty much it. It's, you know, when it comes to digital cable, and of course, this is the place where, you know, the critics really get all up in arms because it's ones and zeros, man. But, you know, the ones and zeros are defined by the leading edge of a square wave. And if the leading edge of the square wave is time delayed, that's what jitter is. So you can have extreme jitter examples where a digital word is completely misconstrued. Now that would involve a lot of jitter, but when you minimize jitter, it does have obvious audible response.
So I would think in most studios, that would be the place to go right away. You know, because obviously that, you know, we're in a digital world for the most part, except for the input and the output of your system. And it's, well, mostly anyway, I know there are exceptions, but you know, most of us are in the digital world now. So that makes a big difference, I would think, right?
It really does. And you had mentioned Greg Calbee. Greg's been using our cables for well over a decade. And we recently came out with our Series 7 a year ago. And we had just, you know, within the last maybe 9 months or so, maybe a little longer than that, but we had recently taken him new cables. And the first cable that we tried out was a long digital cable, a 110 ohm ES-EBU cable. And that, you know, had him look at us and say, okay, we've got to do the rack, you know, but so.
And, you know, that seems to be something that most musicians in their studios, they overlook. You know, they see something with an XLR connector, and it's like, okay, well, I will put just whatever has an XLR connector, then
sure.
You know, as an interconnect, rather than
sure.
thinking, well, wait a second, there's a good reason for having, you know, a digitally designed cable.
Right. Well, digital cables, you know, to use a cable that's the wrong impedance is going to doom you to subpar performance right there. I mean, if you just throw a mic cable that's not designed to be a 110 ohm cable into an AES-EBU application, it's not going to perform as well as a generic designed 110 ohm cable.
Yeah, right.
You know, SPDIF is 75 ohms, USB audio is 90 ohms, and AES-EBU is 110 ohms, and those things are what they are for a reason. So that's something that, you know, cable designers should at least get that part right.
Yeah, you know, it's something that I don't think that the knowledge out there is spread enough on that. I mean, it's not something that's talked about very often, and I don't see that discussed anywhere at great depth.
You know, I went into a music store down here that's pretty much a boutique shop. I mean, it's where I go to look at instruments. And, you know, in our quest, what we do, we're more concerned about bypass testing than anything else. But yes, I like to get my hands on generic products. And, I went into this music store and I asked for an AES EBU cable. And the manager of the accessory division had no idea what I was talking about. I said, well, it's a digital cable that's XLR. He's like, oh, my cables are over there. I said, no, it's, you know, it's 110 ohm. And, you know, it took a long time for him to finally figure out they didn't have one in the shop.
But see, that's something that you guys should be doing is education, because I think that would sell a lot more product.
Well, it's not just about selling product. It's, you know,
well, it's better sound.
For us,
sure,
for us, it is about selling product, but, you know, but yeah. It is a matter of, you know, you want things to be right. And, you know, we do try really hard to do some educational stuff, but I absolutely agree with you that we've got to get better at it.
How about consumer? Is your consumer business a lot larger than your pro business? It must be, I would think.
Yeah, it is. I mean, our pro business, we just launched WireWorld Pro Audio at NAMM. Now, we've been supplying product for Studio Market, but, you know, when we came out with the Series 7 stuff just over a year ago, we came out with cables specifically for pro applications. Our instrument cables, which are not still completely in production, and I'll get to that in a second. We've got a lot of prototypes out in the market, but we don't have what we consider finished goods. And the difference between a pro cable, we offer the same type of step up with materials and price points. They're much more flexible. It's smaller gauge cable that's much more flexible, and it's much easier to, you know, if you're trying to do a patch bay, you're trying to do rack gear where you've got a lot of connectors. You know, typically high-end consumer cable is stiffer and a bit more unwieldy. So we've got stuff that you know, handles much better and is just, you know, it's application driven. It's application specific. Yeah. So yes, the answer to your question is our consumer side is many times the size of our pro side. And previously, what pros have been using is consumer product. You know, it's only in the last year that we've had products specifically for professional application.
What's the best seller on the consumer side? Is it HDMI cables?
HDMI. Actually, we were the first people to offer an upgraded HDMI, and we were also the first people to offer a $1,000 1 meter HDMI, and we were the first people to get death threats from consumers because of offering a $1,000 1 meter HDMI. But, you know, when you do solid silver conductors in HDMI, it's expensive. Again, it's proprietary design, and you know, we're really another thing that makes us unique in the industry. Is the fact that we're an engineering-driven company. We're not a, you know, I don't want this to sound wrong, but we're not a company that started as a business plan, you know. And so our product, the cost to the consumer is basically always reflective of our cost of materials and labor. So, you know, it's not like we just sit around and say, wow, this thing sounds great. This should be a $400 cable. You know, if it's a $400 cable, it's because it costs a certain amount for us to produce the product.
Wow. Well, that makes sense. It's good to hear, actually, because, you know, not the case with a lot of companies.
Particularly in this industry, yeah. It's definitely not the case with a lot of companies.
It's what the market will bear for the most
right.
part. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, back to the studio for a second. So I have a microphone in the studio, and I take one of your cables, and let's say it's a 15-footer. And I plug it from the microphone into the patch bay on the wall. And then it goes through another 20 feet plus of cable before it actually hits the mic preamp.
Right.
Is there going to be a difference? Because obviously there's the weak link in the chain is that other 20 feet of cable.
Yeah. 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 There's going to be a difference. You know, that application, it may not be as great because you've got the limiting factor of the other cable. It may not be as great as if you went, you know, straight to a mic preamp. But, you know, to kind of turn this around, the same thing happens when you use a power cord. You know, and I know we haven't been talking about power chords up to now.
Oh, I'd love to get there. Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, but you know, I always have people tell me, but you know, my house is wired with this stuff, you know, this Romex stuff, and you're telling me that plugging into an outlet and then into my gear is going to make an audible difference. And I don't care that it's going down, you know, maybe hundreds of miles from a transmission station to you. Yes, that last 6 feet makes a difference. In the case of the microphone that you just described, if I can more accurately deliver that first 15 feet of signal, it will make a difference. And like I say, I'm not going to say that it's as dramatic as not running into an inferior cable, but you'll still hear it.
Okay. Let's go to the power cables.
Yeah.
This is one that baffles me. I mean, I'm with you on signal cables. I have no problem. Speaker cables, right. I have no problem with that. And I must admit, I've never done the A-B test, so I can't say.
Right.
But, you know, it again, when I look at it intellectually, it baffles me. So okay. Can you change my mind?
Absolutely. And once again, I can only speak for my specific product because I've read websites where people are describing power cables as signal cables. You know, hear us, we're giving you a really heavy gauge cable and you're going to get everything from that outlet that your amplifier needs. Everything your amplifier needs happens to be 60 cycles. Okay, that's, you know, I mean, ideally 60 cycles with no hash is what your amplifier wants. And so we build power cables that are actually filters. They're very high inductance. They're very high capacitance. If you take a look at them, there's 24 wires wrapped around an oval, and it's basically a big inductive coil. And I'd like to tell you that I only pass 60 hertz, but that's not real. But the fact is, they filter more at longer lengths because it takes length for the filtration to propagate. But by the time you hit 2 meters, that cable is only passing about 100 hertz and below. So all of that chatter on the AC, I mean, if you plug an oscilloscope, you know, take a look at an AC signal with an oscilloscope, and you're going to see a ton of hash up around 1K. Amplifiers don't like, no component likes that. And yet that's what's going into the power supply. And the power supply is trying to work to filter that stuff. And yes, there are spectacular pieces with phenomenal power supplies that do a great job of filtering the AC. But, you know, if you can give it a pre-filtered AC, that component's going to sound better.
Congratulations. I get it.
Well, now, unfortunately, like I say, you know, some of our competitors, I have literally read things where they're talking about, you know, getting everything out of the wall. And it's like, actually, this is funny. At the Consumer Electronics Show this past year, I had a manufacturer of AC conditioners tell me how his product is so pure that if you're in your theater room and the compressor on your refrigerator kicks on, you can hear it. Or if someone flips on a light switch in the back bedroom, you can hear it. That's how pure this product is. And I'm thinking, that's not, you know, that's the antithesis of what I want. You know, really, right. You know, I would like to think that my household AC compressor can kick on and it's not going to change the sound.
That's right,
in my system.
Yeah.
But you know, that he thought that just meant, man, his stuff is the best.
Well, yeah, okay, that's marketing speak and someone who's uninformed, I agree. But let's come back to that again. I guess there's the same problem that you have where you have a studio with a lot of components that are connected to AC.
Sure.
What do you, and a limited amount of money, let's say.
Right.
So
right.
What do you do first?
Yeah. Once again, you know, you put the best cable on the best components. I mean, it's, you know, everything doesn't have to have an upgraded power cord. I can tell you something that does happen. There are a lot of power conditioners on the market that actually pretty much destroy audio. And so you can take your favored mic preamp and plug it into the wall. And if it sounds way better plugged into the wall than plugged into the power distribution system that you had, you know, you might need to look for a better power distribution system.
Yeah, I'd say.
But So, you know, I don't necessarily, I mean, obviously I'd love to see people upgrade every single cable that they have. Honestly, I don't do that in my own studio. But, you know, critical gear, you know, absolutely. And believe it or not, guitar amps, bass amps love good power cords.
Interesting. And you would think, okay, bass amp I get because you do want a certain purity. Well, most of the time anyway. But for guitar amps, of course, you know, guitar players, we like it dirty. We like some grit to it. And you would think that that would defeat the purpose in a way.
No, it doesn't. Believe me, it's not turning down the distortion capabilities of anything. You know, if
saturation.
Right. Yeah. If you're using a tube amp, you know, all I'm doing is taking the gunk out of the AC line. You know, that rectifier is a happier rectifier if it's getting something that's, you know, that's clean.
I got it. Okay. Wow. Well, this has been really enlightening, I got to say. Again, I always knew that unsignal cables and speaker cables, there's a difference, but you just explained it to me. You actually made me believer on the power cables, because up until now, I was scratching my head on that and thinking, wow, I don't know if I get that spend on that. But now I get it. So thank you for that. That was cool.
Sure.
Let's talk about when you're laying one of your cables against power cables or other cables. So in other words, does proximity to other cables make a big difference on you with your cables?
Well, with any cable, you know, you don't want to run signal cables parallel with electric lines whenever you can help it. But realistically, if you do a good job controlling noise, and again, both the geometry that we use and the actual insulation material, we are using a proprietary insulation that's a composite. We call it Composilex 2. That's obviously just a name, but it's a secret formula insulation that provides a cable that rejects noise better than anything else. So if you're talking about running a lot of signal cables together, it's not an issue at all. It's not like you run into a lot of crosstalk or anything like that.
Well, with the fact that you have a premium cable, then, so you're saying it's less susceptible, right? If I'm getting this
absolutely,
right.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We do a better job rejecting noise than virtually anything else out there. Our noise floor inherently is lower, and we reject noise better than just about anything else. When David did the first instrument cable, he gave me a prototype, and he told me what it was going to sound like. He knew from his engineering background what the sonic characteristics were going to be, and he looked at me and says, "You know what I can't predict is how well this thing is going to be shielded from, you know, from electrical issues." So I threw it over the power supply of a desktop computer, a laptop computer. I draped it over a transport. I had it all kinds of things, and you know, I was able to report back to him, it's dead quiet. It's the quietest. And with Microphonics again at NAMM, we had premium cables, expensive cables at least comparable to ours in price, that we can make the cable feedback. You know, now that's a lot of gain at the amp, but the idea that you're getting feedback through a cable with no guitar connected, just a cable, you know, that's an extremely Microphonic cable.
I would say, yeah.
Of course. So I've got a whole litany of things that, you know, if someone calls and asks for tech support, the chances are real good they're going to get me. And I've got a little litany of things to have people do to test cable if they're, you know, if they're ever interested. You know, and what we were doing is we were plugging a guitar cable into an amp and turning the preamp section way up just to hear the noise floor of the cable. And then if you unplug the cable, leaving the amp up, unplug it from the amp, any change in noise, that's the noise floor of the cable. That's all that it is. And we did that. Somebody had come by the booth. They had just purchased a cable from one of our competitors, and they wanted to try this, wanted to hear that cable, and we plugged it in and actually fed back.
Wow. Said,
oh, that's something we hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, I'll say. Wow. Interesting. Okay, so what are the other things that you would go through? You say you have a litany of things that you'd ask somebody.
Well, you know, I like for clarity of a cable, I mean, like you said, guitarists like it dirty, but, you know, I like playing really clean passages with dense chord clusters. You know, if you get solid string to string and note to note definition, you're going to be able to hear more of the differences in a cable than if you are just running a dimed preamp. You know, overdrive is a beautiful thing, and God knows I use it more than I use clean tones. But if I want to know what filtering effects a cable's having, I want that to be very clean. I do recommend that you tap a cable for microphonics, because it's something that, you know, people just don't think about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that you just don't think about.
Well, I know that from way, way back when I first started to play, you know, you'd get your cable and you'd fling it and you could hear it. You could
hear it. I mean, absolutely.
It was just part of what happens with cables, so it was no big deal.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't have to be. Yeah.
Good to know.
You know, there was something I alluded to earlier, too, that I want to kind of correct, just expound upon. I mentioned that our instrument cables, we have a lot of what we consider prototypes out there. And all that comes down to is, you know, David doesn't ever want to do a Me Too product. He wants to do class-leading designs and everything. And we've been going through an arduous task of redesigning the quarter-inch plug. We offer a quarter-inch plug in two different configurations. One is a standard nickel plug because everybody else does it. We've got to have an entry-level cable that hits a better price point. It's a $20 premium to go to our silver over copper contact plug, though. So here you have a plug that's the actual contact is OFC copper, and there's a heavy application of silver over that. It doesn't look like any other quarter-inch plug out there. It doesn't sound like any other quarter. I mean, you know, taking the exact same cable just with a Switchcraft or a Neutrik or our nickel plug and then go to the silver plug, you will hear a difference. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, I've played guitar for like 34 years now. It never occurred to me how many parts are actually in a quarter-inch plug. And we are on a quest to have the not only the best sounding, but also the most robust plug out there.
Oh, I love it.
A lot of plugs, you can grab that tip, the contact, and you'll actually be able to turn it. Yeah. And if you can turn it, you could eventually turn it to the point of breaking contact at that hot lead inside the cable.
Yeah.
And we're working on solving that. So we don't quite have the finalized. I think we're within weeks of having a finalized product, and then we're going to really, you know, go after the marketing for the pro market really hard.
Very cool. Thanks for the education, Larry. This is great.
Bobby, it's my pleasure.
If you want to find out more about WireWorld Cable, go to wireworldproaudio.com. That's wireworldproaudio, all one word, .com. Or you can go to their main consumer site, which is wireworldcable.com. WireWorld Cable is all one word. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. I really enjoy reading your comments, so don't hesitate to send them. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he's responsible for putting this podcast together after it gets recorded. Thank you so much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby O's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find us on iTunes. At bobbyosinski.com, there are links to my blogs and coaching programs, as well as a sign-up sheet for my newsletter, and the newsletter that will give you an alert whenever a new podcast is posted. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.